babyish. Small leaves seem each stream, horses' tails that swish, and the chimes remind us of sweet birds singing, like the jangling bells on rose trees ringing. Man must say farewells to parents now, and to William Tell and Mrs. Cow. Man must say farewells to storks and bets.
The poet, performer and one-off personality, Dame Edith Sitwell, with The Yodeling Song from Facade. Kerry Jean Ross here, and welcome to Replay. Good to have you along. From deep in the ABC archive, Dame Edith Sitwell will emerge soon. And after that, the Pied Piper, the late Keith Smith, another real original of Australian television and radio.
What's your father's job?
He's a statistician at the university.
What does he do exactly? Describe his job, Stephen.
I think it's adding up numbers.
Doesn't he talk about it when he comes home?
Only about his secretaries.
Well, I hope they add up too.
Keith Smith died recently at age 94. Stay with Replay for a wise and very smart interview he had with Carolyn Jones in 1987. To say that Dame Edith Sitwell was an extraordinary woman would be an understatement. Poet, performer, critic, and the artistic trailblazer, sometimes described as the very first rapper. This piece comes from the BBC, circa 1987.
Dame Edith Sitwell was, of course, chiefly a serious poet, but among her other attributes was a great sense of fun, displayed to advantage in Facade, an entertainment for orchestra and reciter. And here's Dame Edith performing the polka to William Walton's music.
Dance the polka, said Mr. Wag like a bear, with my top hat and my whiskers that trap the fair. When the waves seem chiming haycocks, I dance the polka there. Sand Venus children in a gay frocks, maroon the marina stare. To see me fire my pistol, through the distance blows my coat, like Wellington Bar and the Marquis of Bristol, Busby's great trees float. Where the wheezing hurdy-gurdy off the marine wind blows me, to the tune of Annie Mooney, sturdy over the sheets of the sea, and bright as seedsman's packet, with zinnias candy tufts chill, is Mrs. Marigold's jacket, as she gapes at the indoor still. Where a dawn in the box of the sailor, blue as the decks of the sea, Nelson awoke, crowed like the cocks, and back to the dust sand he. And Robinson Crusoe, Russo, the bright and foxy beer. But he finds where shiles and the negress that smiles, the foxy doxy dear. I say, but you dance the polka, said Mr. Wag-a-bear. In my top hat and whiskers that tra-trap the bear. Tra-la-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la.
It was with Facade, first performed publicly at the Aeolian Hall in London in June 1923, that the name Sitwell became a popular synonym for all that was at best silly and at worst somehow wicked, almost obscene, in modern literature. In her memoirs, Dame Edith wrote, "Never, I should think, was a larger and more imposing shower of brickbats hurled at any new work." Now, of course, the same work is admired and performed throughout the world. Edith Sitwell was the elder member of her generation of the Sitwell family. Both her brothers, Osbert and Sacheverell, were to make their own mark in the arts. Osbert as an autobiographer of genius, but also as poet and short story writer. Sacheverell as a remarkable writer on the arts and also as a poet. The family itself was a remarkable one, as Dame Edith reminded viewers in the face-to-face television programme she recorded in 1959.
I'm descended from the most queer and remote sources. On one side, My maternal grandmother is to send it straight from the Red Rose Plantagenets, the Dukes of Beaufort. My grandmother was the daughter of the Duke of Beaufort of her time, are to send it straight from the Red Rose Plantagenets. And on another side, I'm descended from an errand boy who walked barefoot from Leeds to London and built up a large fortune. Well, I'm extremely proud of his having walked barefoot from Leeds. I think it's magnificent. And that persistence and grandeur, I'm extremely proud of. And his niece was the woman who was known as the wicked Lady Cunningham, who was my great-great-grandmother, and who was so wicked that she prevented, she stopped the flogging in women's prisons and was going to stop the flogging in men's prisons in the army and navy. But George IV died, and so this wicked woman was left to her own devices, having only prevented the flogging in women's prisons. But I'm proud of that particular thing.
Not greatly encouraged by her parents to take any interest in the arts, Edith Sitwell was in fact interested in nothing else. Her first collection of poems, The Mother, was published in 1915, when she was in her 20s. Facade, a collection of nonsense poems written as technical exercises in versification, followed. Then came Bucolic Comedies and The Sleeping Beauty, a series of poems embroidering the old fairy story. Fairy stories were, in fact, apart from Shakespeare, almost the only literature Dame Edith had to read when she was young.
Well, fairy stories, to begin with. There were really no books in the house. When I was 13, I learned The Rape of the Lock by heart off my own bat, but I was never able to learn The Boy Stood on the Burning Deck, which almost struck me as being the supreme instance of human idiocy that I've ever come across. Because why stand on the burning deck when everyone else has fled? Do you see what I mean?
It's
silly, don't you think so? And I was kept in every Saturday by my governess because I couldn't learn it by heart and wouldn't. But I got hold of The Rape of the Lock and at the age of 13 learned the whole thing by heart without being told to do so. And then started on Shakespeare. And I cannot tell you the quantity that I knew of Shakespeare at the age of 14.
Which fairy stories did you like best? Whose?
Grimm.
Rather than Hans Andersen?
I was frightened by Hans Andersen. I was frightened by the awful sort of coldness and...
But you would say Shakespeare was really your childhood influence?
Oh, yes.
And in prose?
Oh, yes.
But...
The prose of Shakespeare, but of the prose writer? I don't think that I read any prose as a child. I mean, only sort of silly stories that one is given, you know, by one's grandmother and aunts.
Dame Edith was speaking in a radio programme called Frankly Speaking, also recorded in the 1950s. And by that time, she'd become something of a national institution. But for much of her life, though she'd been praised by W.B. Yeats while she was still very young, she'd been pilloried for her experiments and sneered at for alleged pretentiousness and laughed at for her interest in the new and the strange. Most of her poetry is, in fact, extremely accessible. In a conversation with Gilbert Harding, when she was asked about her youth, she quoted one of her loveliest early poems, Colonel Fantock, first published in 1925.
But Dagobert and Peregrine and I were children then. We walked like shy gazelles among the music of the thin flower bells. And life still held some promise, never ask of what, but life seemed less a stranger then than ever after in this cold existence. I always was a little outside life, and so the things we touch could comfort me. I loved the shy dreams we could hear and see, for I was like one dead, like a small ghost, a little cold air wandering and lost. All day within the straw-roofed arabesque of the towered castle and the sleepy gardens wandered we, those delicate paladins the waves, told us fantastic legends that we pondered, and the soft leaves were breasted like a dove, crooning old mournful tales of untrue love.
What is the background of those beautiful lines?
It had a good many backgrounds, really. It had the background of Renishaw and the background of Montecuffoni, which I had seen, but, well, of course, we lived there also. And also the background of my grandmother's families, houses, one in Wales, which was called Troy House, which I'd never seen, but the name had a great effect on me.
Dame Edith wrote a great deal about the technique of poetry, both other people's and her own. During Frankly Speaking, Lionel Hale, Paul Dane and Margaret Lane got onto that subject. But first, Margaret Lane asked Dame Edith about the outward face she presented to the world. A very ornate, highly decorated, some might say artificial face.
Of all the people in our time, you seem to me to be the one who's been most creative about her own appearance. Listeners at this moment can't see you as we can in your gold-embroidered coat and your four wonderful great rings on your hands and that beautiful Renaissance jewel that I can see. And I would like to know whether this is a thing that's come with time through your life or whether when you were a girl you looked in the glass and said to yourself, this is the kind of appearance that I want to have, and consciously and creatively began to build it.
No, I never bothered. It came natural.
Yes.
If I have any appearance at all, which I don't know, but it is partly inherited and is partly completely natural, as much as the skin of the panther is natural.
But it's very stylized, isn't it? It's wonderful and stylized.
I suppose it is stylized, but I never think of it at all, you know.
Would that mean, then, that you're a very stylized person, do you mean?
It means that I am exactly as I was born. I have never thought anything out about myself at all, excepting about my poetry, which naturally I think about. I mean, I think about the technical side of my poetry the whole time, what I must do, what I mustn't do, and so forth. And I think about other human beings. But do you know, I really don't think about myself.
That's very interesting.
The technical side of your poetry, then, Dame Edith, I am always interested, I don't know whether other people are too, in how poems are written in terms of sheer mechanics of writing.
Sweat, blood and tears, and great joy.
Yes.
And great excitement, and one line to begin with. And I think that poems sometimes have parents. I mean, I can think of one poem of mine, which is called The Youth with the Red Gold Hair.
Yes.
And the Roman road runs through part of Renishaw Park. And when I was a young girl, I used to sit there and look at cornfields, the other side of the Roman road. And I thought of one line, and then, when I was older, that was before I began to write poetry, when I was older, I heard Debussy's Quartet. And that was the other parent of that poem.
The two came together and mated it, as well, and
yes,
produced the
yes,
poem.
Yes, yes.
Can you tell us the line?
I never remember any poem of my own. Ah. Wait a moment.
But we have them.
The gold armor ghost. From the Roman road, sighed over the wheat. Fear not the sound and the glamour of my gold armour, the sound of the wind and the wheat.
And now here's Dame Edith reading the whole of one of her poems, a poem called Most Lovely Shade, which she wrote during the war in what some critics would say was her best period.
Most lovely dark, my Ethiopia born, of the shade's richest splendour, leave not me, where in the pomp and splendour of the shade, the dark air's leafy plumes no more a lulling music made. Dark is your fleece, and dark the airs that grew amid those weeping leaves. Plantations of the east drop precious dew that ripen by the light. Rich leaves perspire, such are the drops that from the dark air's feathers flew. most lovely shade, Syrinx and Dryope, and that smooth nymph that changed into a tree, are dead. The shade that Ethiopia sees, their beauty make more bright its treasuries. Their amber blood in porphyry veins still grows deep in the dark secret of the rose and the smooth stem of many a weeping tree, and in your beauty grows. Come then, my pomp and splendor of the shade, most lovely cloud that the hot sun made black as dark-leaved airs. Come then, O precious cloud, lean to my heart. No shade of a rich tree shall pour such splendor as your heart to me.
The reaction of artists to criticism varies wildly. Some sit still under even the most unfair criticism, and however wounded they may be by it, never reply. But Dame Edith wasn't given to that kind of reticence. She gave as good as she got, and sometimes better. Consequently, she built up a reputation for belligerence and quick temper.
I don't think I'm forbidding, excepting when I absolutely refuse to be taught my job by people who know nothing about it. I have devoted my whole life to writing poetry, which is to be a form of religion, and I'm not going to be taught by people who don't know anything about it. I think it's very impertinent. I mean, I don't teach plumbers how to plumb.
But apart from her notorious battles with critics, she was also a lifelong campaigner.
For any kind of new great work which was coming along. I mean, we have, after all, found and helped a good many great artists in various arts. We really have, you know. And against cruelty, against injustice, against snobbery.
Some of her campaigns were reflected in the tone of her prose books, which often show a sympathy and tolerance which her public utterances might not have conveyed. Her book about Alexander Pope, and the two Elizabethan books, Fanfare for Elizabeth and The Queens and the Hive, are quite as individual as her poetry, her style as instantly recognisable, her wit as striking and amusing. But it was by her poetry that she would have wished to be judged. In Song of the Cold, also written during the last war, she had these lines: "The great sins and fires break out of me like the terrible leaves from the bough in the violent spring. I am a walking fire. I am all leaves."
The great fire, I suppose, is a humble but unworthy love of God, and certainly a great love of humanity. And to be an artist is a terribly painful thing. I mean, the great leaves break out of me. You see, one has a perpetual resurrection in one's life as the art returns to one after long deadness. You see? And, of course, the fire's always fighting with sins, and, well, there one is.
The general public, I think, especially when Dame Edith became a great national figure, thought of her as a rather angular woman, always rushing out, brandishing a blunt weapon with which to strike down someone who'd offended her. In fact, she was also immensely kind, immensely loyal. In fact, that loyalty often provoked her into violent action against some critic who'd attacked a friend. Even in Facade, that most joyous of entertainments, the note of melancholy strikes through the humour, as in Yodeling Song.
We bear velvet cream, green and baby-ish, small leaves seem each stream, horses' tails that swish, and the chimes remind us of sweet birds singing like the jangling bells on rose trees ringing. Man must say farewells to parents now and to William Tell and Mrs. Cow. Man
and must say farewells to storks and bets and to roses' bells and statuettes, forests white and black, in spring are blue with forget-me-nots and to lovers true still the sweet bird begs and tries to cozen them by angels' eggs sold by the dozen. Gone are cloud-like inns on the garden's brinks and the mountain gins. Ganymede sells drinks while the days seem grey and his heart of ice grey a chamois or the edelweiss. And the mountain screams like cowbells sound, tira-lira drowned in the waiter's gleams. Who has gone beyond the forest waves while his true and proud ones seek their graves?
I think that poetry is really a form of religion. I mean, there may be many forms of poetry. There's gay poetry, there's sad poetry, there's love poetry, there's religious poetry. But it is a form of religion inasmuch as it does, I think, or should bring people nearer to God and make them more humane to their fellow men. I think, in fact, that it should make all our days holy to us.
That it is not explicitly but implicitly, it is dogmatic.
Not dogmatic, no. Just what Emerson called a larger imbibing of the common heart, which I think is a wonderful phrase, don't you? There was one wonderful phrase that Nietzsche used. He spoke about the animalization of God. And I think in a way poetry is almost that, you see, in some way. Just taking the Holy Spirit and using the world as a sort of body for it.
John Layman not only published Dame Edith, not only has written widely about her, but also knew her for a very long period, fairly intimately, and he's been listening with me to these recordings. Mr. Layman, it's true to say, I suppose, isn't it, that although perhaps her originality has been overstated in the last few years, she was still, at the time when she started publishing, a very original poet indeed.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. Facade, which was the sort of main peak point of her early poetry, is an extremely original creation and, to my mind, unlike anything else in English poetry. It's this mixture of extraordinary technical accomplishment and gaiety and imaginative power, and this mixture of imagery from every kind of source, from fairy tales, from the Bible, from Christian sources, and from family things too. That's a unique mixture, I think.
Of course, there haven't been a great number of really good women poets, so to call her that isn't really to flatter her much. But, I mean, she's on the level of, say, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, Christina Rossetti, isn't she?
Well, I think she's better than Elizabeth Barrett Browning, certainly. Christina Rossetti is another matter, and there are one or two others. But to my mind, she's, without doubt, with Christina Rossetti, the greatest woman poet in our language.
And great as the earth's story, for though the soundless wrinkles fall like snow on many a golden cheek, and creeds grow old and change, man's heart, that sun, outlives all terrors shaking the old night. The world's huge fevers burn and shine, turn cold. Yet the heavenly bodies and young lovers burn and shine. The golden lovers walk in the holy fields where the Abraham-bearded son, the father of all things, is shouting of ripeness, and the whole world of dews and splendors are singing to the cradles of earth, of men, beasts, harvests, swinging in the peace of God's heart. And I, the primeval clay that has known earth's grief and harvest's happiness, seeing mankind's dark seed time, come to bless, forgive and bless all men like the holy light.
Dame Edith Sitwell, poet and perhaps the world's very first rapper.